race for a vaccine is showing progress today, but some health officials worry about what could come next.
People are starting to be concerned that even if somebody succeeds, not everybody will get equitable access to that vaccine.
Meantime, coronavirus is breaking out in the Amazon rainforest, where information is scarce. Enter a powerful old technology, the two-way radio.
It's essential to tell people about the threat of this disease. That way they can protect themselves.
And in Canada, activists protesting human rights abuses by China are met with stiff resistance.
Beijing has launched an unprecedented attack on Canadian soil.
We also go to Venice.
Everything is reachable in a 10 or 15 minute walk.
Without tourists, locals are reminded how well Venice was designed. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. A microscopic virus has brought us to our knees. Words today from UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. He was virtually addressing the annual World Health Assembly, the decision-making body of the World Health Organization.
COVID-19 must be a wake-up call. It is time for an end of this hubris. Our deep feelings of powerlessness must lead to greater humility.
The meeting typically runs more than a week. This year, it's jammed into 2 days online. And yeah, there were the expected technical bumps.
South Africa, can you please join us?
I'm afraid we still don't have Germany. We would go to Fiji.
While we are waiting for the connection.
Connectivity aside, the pandemic has turned the annual assembly of global health leaders into a highly charged political moment. The world's Ilana Gordon has been following the developments.
Yeah, Marco, it has been an especially political moment for the global health community. To understand this context, I just want to tell you about the role of the World Health Assembly and what it does. So remember, it's the WHO when they declare a global health emergency. This is the group that allows them to do that.
So clearly this is a big year. What's different at the assembly this year?
A lot of people I talked to were struck by who even showed up, because usually, again, these are like ministers of health. And this time there were a lot of world leaders. So you had the president of France, Emmanuel Macron. He addressed the assembly and spoke of the need for a strong World Health Organization and that everyone, all countries, need to join together in this fight. Then there was the president of South Africa who spoke about how it's the poor who are suffering most from this virus. The president, Marco, of South Korea talked about the need for transparency, democracy, and solidarity. And then...
I welcome to speak next His Excellency President Xi Jinping, President of the People's Republic of China.
To begin with, I wish to say...
So, Marco, you're hearing a translator of China's president, Xi Jinping, speaking. He said that solidarity and cooperation is the way that the people of the world can defeat this novel coronavirus. He then pledged $2 billion for the WHO over the next 2 years.
So messages of investment in the WHO, also hearing some messages of solidarity. It does lead me to a big question, Ilana, the elephant in the room, or rather the absence of it. Where was the U.S.?
As you know, earlier, the United States announced it was pulling funding for the WHO. It was not present at the big kickoff of a big coordinated collaboration to develop vaccines and treatments. But U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar did address the assembly later in the day with a much sharper, more critical tone.
We must be frank about one of the primary reasons this outbreak spun out of control. There was a failure by this organization to obtain the information that the world needed, and that failure cost many lives.
It sounds like Secretary Azar is throwing shade on the World Health Organization there.
It sounds like it. And, you know, he talked about the billions that the U.S. is investing in taking on this virus around the globe, but that there really needs to be an independent investigation of the WHO, and that at least one member state, though we didn't say China by name, tried to conceal the outbreak. So, you know, what's interesting, too, is that countries talked about their challenges in addressing the World Health Assembly as well, but what didn't go mentioned in this instance is that the U.S. does have the most cases and most deaths right now.
So you gave us a good picture of the politics at the World Health Assembly. What is actually being reviewed there, Ilana?
The Assembly agreed to review a resolution at a later time about Taiwan, and this has been a big political issue for the U.S. and China. The resolution would allow Taiwan to have an observational role at the World Health Assembly, which would allow it to have a representative to speak, because right now Taiwan's not recognized as a country or member state, similar to how it is in the United Nations.
The World's Ilana Gordon getting us started today on our COVID-19 coverage, telling us about the World Health Assembly happening this year online. Ilana, thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
A Saudi aviation student who killed three sailors on a Florida Navy base in December had ties to Al-Qaeda. This was announced today by the FBI after investigators broke through encryptions on the gunman's iPhones. Matthew Levitt is the director of counterterrorism and intelligence at the Washington Institute. Matthew, what evidence did the FBI reveal today about Al-Qaeda's role in this shooting?
What they revealed is that the FBI, through its own painstaking work, without getting help from Apple, had been able to break into the iPhone and basically confirm what AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, had already said. They claimed responsibility for this attack 2 months afterwards. They published a video, including screenshots from his phone. But we now know they were using end-to-end encrypted applications and that al-Shamrani was recruited back in 2015 and then sent basically to get a position in the Royal Saudi Air Force. And we know that he was having conversations with Al-Qaeda associates overseas. In fact, the Department of Justice says today that that went right up until the attack itself. And so that's pretty significant. Al-Qaeda has been a little more quiet than, say, the Islamic State over the past few years, but it demonstrates their willingness to be patient as they continue to try and plot out attacks targeting the United States.
So Lieutenant Mohammed al-Shamrani was weaponized before he even arrived in Pensacola. How is Al-Qaeda able to influence a Saudi military man to carry out an attack on American soil?
Well, in part, we now know that he was radicalized even prior to joining the Saudi Air Force. I mean, there are lots of reasons why someone from Saudi Arabia might be inclined to join Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. There are lots of Saudis in AQAP, even though the group is based primarily now in Yemen. What's interesting is their kind of strategic vision to be willing to slowly take someone who is radicalized, convince them to go get a job in the military. Al-Shamrani was at multiple U.S. bases before ultimately carrying out the attack in Pensacola. Imagine among the things that authorities are already looking into is what kind of information might he have been collecting and sending back to Al-Qaeda over the course of those years in those various places.
We saw the tension that grew between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia after 9/11. Should we be surprised that al-Shamrani was able to do this, that Al-Qaeda was able to do this?
So it is surprising, less so because he's Saudi, more so because the U.S. military does vetting of individuals before they can participate in these programs. But it also underscores the fact that there's no such thing as 100% success in counterterrorism. We have people here in the United States, American citizens, who get radicalized, whether it's to a jihadi ideology or some type of neo-Nazi or other right-wing or left-wing ideology. Just the fact that he was a Saudi citizen doesn't necessarily mean that the Saudis weren't doing what they could to prevent something like this from happening. And one could argue that in years prior, leading up to and around 9/11, maybe they weren't doing as much. They weren't.
Just to underscore one of your takeaways, Matthew, you don't think this news is going to have much of an impact on U.S.-Saudi relations?
I think there are so many reasons why U.S. And Saudi interests coincide, whether it's because of threats from Iran or other things. I think that unless we find out that the Saudis turned a blind eye, that somehow Saudi authorities knew about this, or that Saudi authorities were knowingly helping someone, that this is something different than what we saw on 9/11. Leading up to 9/11, Saudi Arabia had been financing all kinds of extremist ideological materials around the world. There were Saudi diplomats who had been helpful to some of the hijackers, though there's no evidence they actually knew about 9/11. In this case, I don't think we're going to find evidence like that. At least we haven't so far.
Matthew Levitt, the Director of Counterterrorism and Intelligence at the Washington Institute. Thanks for your time.
Always a pleasure.
Another piece of news that reminds us the world keeps turning. A fugitive had been on the run for more than 25 years, even evading a $5 million bounty on his head offered by the U.S. government. But on Saturday, Rwandan Félicien Kabuga was finally arrested by French police in Paris. Kabuga is now 84, and he's accused of playing a major role in the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, where some 800,000 people were massacred. The world's Halima Gikandi has more.
For years, Félicien Kabuga was rumored to be hiding out somewhere in East Africa, supported by powerful allies in the business world. Serge Bremert is the chief prosecutor of the United Nations Residual Mechanism for Criminal Tribunals.
Félicien Kabuga has always been one of the most wanted fugitives. He has always been considered as being one of the masterminds in relation to the genocide.
Kabuga allegedly helped finance Rwanda's genocide by supporting the armed militia groups that murdered civilians. But he is most known for bankrolling a hate-filled radio station, Radio Television Mille Collines.
A radio which was really calling for assassinations, which was really, inciting people to commit genocide and to kill massively.
Genocide survivors like Naftel Ahashakye remember very well what people were saying on the radio about Tutsis like him.
Tutsi is the biggest enemy of Rwanda, of Hutu, and so on. So the radio considered the Tutsi as the animals, cockroaches.
Ahashakye and his family were forced to flee to the forest. About 100 days later, he and his two sisters were the family's only survivors.
Parents, brothers, the other family members, cousins, and so on, uncles were killed during the genocide.
Getting justice has been a long and slow process. In 1995, the UN Security Council established the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. It convicted dozens of people in a court in Tanzania. But until now, one of the most wanted criminals, Felician Kabuga, remained at large. After so many years, Rwandans like Ahashakye began to lose hope.
Nothing was done because of different governments, different countries, which had no goodwill to arrest Kabuga.
The Rwanda tribunal closed in 2015, but outstanding cases like Kabuga's were directed to the international court that Serge Brammertz now leads. He says he never gave up catching Kabuga. 2 years ago, he assembled a task force to track him down in partnership with European authorities.
There were information from so-called credible sources that he would be in Burundi, that he would be in Kenya, in Madagascar, in Gabon, and many other places.
Brammertz tracked Kabuga from Germany, then through Belgium and Luxembourg, identifying people who may have helped him.
Based on the analysis and phone profiles, financial investigation, and I don't want to go into details about it, we concluded 2 months ago that it was very, very likely that he was in a certain specific area in Paris.
Working with French authorities, they closed in on Kabuga's location.
And of course, you know the rest, that the operation took place on Saturday and the operation was successful.
It's a twist of fate that one of the most wanted fugitives of the Rwandan genocide was arrested in France. The relationship between the two countries has been tense for years, marred by accusations that France had played a role in the genocide. It was only last year that French President Emmanuel Macron launched an investigation into his country's role. Steps like that haven't gone unnoticed by survivors like Naftel Ahashakye.
We are happy to see France accepted to facilitate this process to arrest Kabuga.
Kabuga will be transferred to face trial in either Tanzania or The Hague. That depends, of course, on travel restrictions related to the coronavirus. But Brammertz expects him to face trial in the next year. For survivors like Ahashakye, it's one step closer to what has been a long road to justice. For The World, I'm Halima Kikandi.
Coming up, a filmmaker goes inside an ICU in Italy and gets a rare up-close glimpse of the pandemic at its worst. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Here in the U.S., feelings of animosity toward China were looming large already before the pandemic. For a couple of years, tension had been building over trade, and then the coronavirus arrived. There's also the longstanding troubles of Uyghur Muslims in China, and this week the Senate is expected to consider sanctions on Chinese officials over human rights abuses against Uyghurs. Canadian activists are also calling for action by their government, but as The World's Rupa Shenoy reports, the activists say they're being targeted for speaking out.
She first saw them 9 months ago. Gloria Fung was at a rally she helped organize in front of Toronto's old City Hall. It was to show support for pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong.
Soon after we had assembled, more than 100 counter-protesters blocked our way, chanting One China.
Those counter-protesters waved Chinese flags.
They shouted insults and threats and photographed individuals as an intimidation tactic.
After that, Fung says pro-China groups showed up in several Canadian cities, and threats increased against Canadian activists. Fung says those threats aren't random. They're part of a coordinated assault by the Chinese government to shut down criticism of its human rights record.
Beijing has launched an unprecedented attack on Canadian soil.
Fung got threatening phone calls. Her contact information appeared in pornographic ads. Another activist, Chemi Lamo, leader of Students for a Free Tibet Canada, has also been targeted on social media.
I was hit with comments like, when I see you, I will punch you, or your mom is dead.
Lamo, Fung, and a coalition of human rights groups recently released a report that documents a pattern of escalating intimidation directed by forces in China.
The Chinese government ruthlessly tries to crush all dissent and now are on a global mission to silence any criticism of their policies and brutal human rights record at large.
Alex Neve of Amnesty International Canada says few of those who are harassed bother reporting it to authorities anymore. He says that's because they always get a similar response.
We hear a variation of there's not much we can do.
The coalition of human rights groups is calling on the Canadian government to investigate and to consider sanctions. The coalition would like to see legislation that requires Canadians acting on behalf of a foreign government to register themselves. The report also recommends new regulations to protect activists on Canada's college campuses.
Governments like Canada, working with other governments, not on our own, need to be more courageous and determined about standing up to these kinds of human rights violations, including within our own borders.
Canadian officials say they'll study the report's recommendations. The Chinese government hasn't commented. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Italy is on the other side of the coronavirus curve, at least for now. Businesses have slowly begun to reopen. In March, though, it was a total shutdown with the most aggressive spread of coronavirus in the world. ICUs were overwhelmed. London-based Italian filmmaker Sacha Joelle Achille took a risk that has kept many journalists away from ICUs. She traveled back to her home country with a camera to profile for PBS Frontline the daily life of an ICU doctor, Francesca Mangiatordi. Sacha Achille says she met Dr. Mangiatordi online on Instagram.
Francesca took this extraordinary photo and it showed a colleague of hers completely exhausted, collapsed over her desk, which really kind of captured what I think the healthcare workers in Italy at that time and now obviously in most of the world were going through.
Sasha, it was remarkable to not just see footage from an ICU with some pretty desperate cases of COVID-19. I mean, you don't dwell on death in this hour on Frontline, but it must have been everywhere.
We got to a point, I remember one night I was filming the ICU and the nurses were talking about a patient and they couldn't remember the name and it wasn't out of disrespect. It was because people were coming and going and there was a period where a lot of them were dying. As you can see in the film, you know, they're calling for beds, for beds, for beds. Yeah, how many beds are available?
Ciao da pronto soccorso. Mi dici situazione posti, per favore? Vero, grazie.
The doctor's trying to decide who in the ER should be admitted first.
Right.
And, you know, in those early days, some people would have to wait for hours, hours and hours, if not like a day or two in the ER before they found a bed.
Very, very tough. It is the courageous and charismatic Dr. Francesca Mangiatordi who draws us into the intense routine at the hospital. We also meet her family at her home on lockdown.
Okay, sono operativo. Avete studiato, giovinotti? Tutto?
Were you surprised how close physically the doctor was with her family?
Her family wanted to be near her. She really needed them for moral and psychological support in that time. And so the best she could do was, you know, she'd finish her shift, she'd wash at the hospital, go home, wash up, and she was physically close to them, but she didn't touch them. And they kind of decided that that's what they would do. She needed them, and I think they wanted to be by her side in this time.
We know that there have been some people in their teens and 20s who have succumbed to COVID-19. You actually focus on one. He's an 18-year-old named Mattia. How long had you been filming when he came into the hospital in Cremona?
I had been filming for 3 days when he arrived. He arrived at about 3, 4 a.m. and they had to intubate him almost immediately.
Stamattina abbiamo ricoverato un paziente di 18 anni, si chiama Mattia.
When you introduce Mattia, it's Dr. Mangiatordi who remarks how it's almost a natural thing when someone old dies, but when it's a young person, it's the promise of life cut short.
Doctors and nurses had been working tirelessly for, you know, 3.5 weeks since the first case, and the virus, it was winning, you know. Mm. And then when Mattia showed up, it was just like a punch in the gut. Like, no, it can't, you know, this virus can't be taking everyone. It's just, it doesn't stop. It just, everyone's up for grabs. That's how they felt.
Through all of this, we almost never see Dr. Mangiatordi break down. She's a rock. How do the doctors and nurses hold up under this kind of pressure? What did you see?
They're a very tight-knit group of doctors and nurses. They're very, very close. They talk a lot. It's kind of like a therapy for them. Sometimes, you know, if some of the jokes might seem a bit dark, sometimes it's cynicism that helps you get by. Mm. Francesca, she is a very kind of ironic person, but she does break. And in a way, I mean, she said to me, I think when I watch this film, that will be my catharsis. I'll just cry from the beginning to the end. And I feel like in a way she opened her door to me because she wanted somebody to capture that moment in time, that moment in history of what her and her colleagues were going through so that she could then let it go herself.
Sasha Joelle Achille is a producer and director of the documentary Inside Italy's COVID War, airing tomorrow on PBS Frontline. She spoke with us from London. Sasha, thank you very much and stay safe.
Thank you. Thank you, Marco. You too.
Responses to the coronavirus crisis have been varied around the world. There have been smart and aggressive approaches, as well as unfocused and unscientific responses. Where does the U.S. land in that spectrum? That's the focus of our online public forum tomorrow in partnership with Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. We'll be taking your questions for Harvard's Dr. Howard Koh. Email your questions to myworld@theworld.org and join us tomorrow at 12 noon Eastern for the live conversation at theworld.org. Empty gondolas in Venice. The city of canals is usually swarming with tourists. Now it's empty, quiet, and clean. Some locals are conflicted.
Tourism was the number one problem. Now it's the number one problem because it's missing. Before, people complained because tourists were there.
Now Venetians complain because they're gone. That's still ahead here on The World. Brazil is now one of the global epicenters of the pandemic, and the country is facing a rising number of cases without a quartermaster at the helm. Brazil currently has no health minister.
Todos ministros, todos, eu já sei qual é a tua pergunta, você quer dizer o seguinte.
Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro there saying that any and all ministers are political appointees and must be in line with me. Bolsonaro said this after that health minister resigned on Friday. The World's Jorge Valencia has been reporting on this story. Do we know why the health minister resigned, Jorge?
Yes and no. Now former health minister Nelson Teich did not give an official reason as to why he was stepping down. But we do know that he had not seen eye to eye with President Bolsonaro on some key issues. For example, on President Bolsonaro's decision to relax physical distancing guidelines.
No, isso aí não é atribuição nossa. Isso aí é uma decisão do presidente.
So we have the former health minister here saying, don't attribute that to us. The decisions on physical distancing have come either from presidency or they've come from the finance minister.
So who's going to replace the health minister, someone who just agrees with President Bolsonaro?
It certainly seems that way. I wanted to add really quick that this is now the second health minister that Brazil loses during the pandemic. And we know that on Friday, President Bolsonaro met with an oncologist who has been enthusiastic about the use of chloroquine. So, yep, it does seem like it's likely he will choose somebody who is more in line, as he says, with his point of view.
So just how bad is the coronavirus situation in Brazil, Jorge?
Well, there's a group of independent scientists who are doing their own projections as to the number of cases. Brazil has reported more than 244,000. They're saying it is at least 10 times more than that. Dr. Larissa Laura de Oliveira is with the medical school at the University of Sao Paulo, and she says she's concerned about people being confused.
They are thinking that maybe this is a political issue rather than a health issue, and this is something that we need to deal. It's not only the pandemic.
And Gio Oliveira says the effect is that people will then not take the situation seriously enough, and therefore people will get sick more quickly, and ultimately there will be more people dying from this.
The World's Jorge Valencia with the latest coronavirus news out of Brazil. Thanks very much, Jorge.
Thank you, Marco.
The state of Amazonas in the north of Brazil is one of the country's hardest hit places. And now there's a lot of concern about how the coronavirus could impact the large indigenous population living in the rainforest there. Getting reliable information about the virus can be difficult for these communities. As Richard Kemeny reports, the old-fashioned two-way radio is proving essential.
Alio Cardoso sits at a large wooden desk in front of a black box, radio receiver in hand. It looks like a war room, aged photographs and detailed maps along the walls. And Cardoso is speaking to people on the front lines. In the Tucano indigenous language, he's warning people of a silent enemy threatening to sweep through the rainforest. Cardoso says the coronavirus is spreading and that COVID, the white man's disease, presents a huge risk to the indigenous population. Everyone needs to look after each other, he tells his listeners. Cardoso is working with an NGO called the Federation of Rio Negro Indigenous Organizations. The radio station broadcasts out to 23 different indigenous groups. They're spread out across the border area where Brazil, Colombia, and Venezuela come together. Cardoso's broadcast is done on a two-way radio out of São Gabriel de Cachoeira, a city where 90% of the population is indigenous. Keeping the public informed in the middle of the rainforest is critical, but it's not easy. And the radio is proving essential for getting word up the river.
Sou de Neia Teles, do povo Arapaço, tenho 38 anos.
Edineia Teles comes from the Arapaço people. She goes on the air for a couple of hours each day. Teles says the two-way radio broadcast is probably the most important source of information along the Rio Negro.
More than ever, this radio station is a base, a place to pass on communications, to receive messages, among other things. Right now, this is essential for us.
There are 150 or more similar radio stations in villages scattered throughout the region. They pass along messages from one community to another. After that, word of mouth carries the information deeper into the forest.
Before the pandemic, people called into the radio station to tell their families how life was in the city. Now we use it to tell people to not come into the city because the virus is here. We tell them to stay at home, to wash their hands with soap. Our biggest focus is to give people educational messages about COVID-19.
The broadcasts are done in multiple indigenous languages. Medical teams are taking part too to pass on the latest advice about the outbreak.
É melhor agora não, tá bom? Porque as pessoas pode ficar com esse vírus até 14.
That's visiting Dr. Guilherme Monsal, explaining that the virus has an incubation period of 14 days. But the information doesn't flow just one way, up the river. The network allows people to ask questions about the virus, about finding daily necessities, and how to access financial assistance. This is how communities in the rainforest can request help from the authorities, which often arrives by boat. Juliana Radler is with an NGO called Instituto Socioambiental. She says the two-way radio network is key for spreading information over an area that's about the size of Virginia.
Então é desafio, porque você não tem uma infraestrutura de comunicação.
It's a challenge because there's no communication infrastructure here. Most indigenous communities don't have access to the internet.
Radler says it's critical that information reaches these communities, where healthcare systems are pretty basic. There is one hospital in the capital city, but it has no intensive care beds.
A comunicação é um instrumento fundamental, né? Essencial.
The communication system is fundamental. It's essential to tell people about the threat of this disease. That way they can protect themselves and isolate.
And when the coronavirus presents such a serious risk to the indigenous population, the radio network lets them know they're not alone. For The World, I'm Richard Kemeny in Sao Paulo.
The global competition to find a vaccine is fierce. At least 130 labs are racing to be first. That is a good thing. It increases the odds of finding a way to halt the pandemic. At the same time, it's worrisome. With so many competing interests, it's far from clear how people across the world could have equitable access to a new vaccine. It's a problem, says Jane Halton, a former WHO board member, who calls this vaccine nationalism.
I worry that some countries will see that there is strategic advantage in the use of any developed vaccine if they are successful. I also think that there is, in some cases, a need to deal with domestic concerns, and I understand that. Being able to balance a need for domestic distribution, particularly for the vulnerable, but at the same time acknowledging that all countries are in this together, I think there's a middle line to be struck here.
Yeah, I mean, scientific teams in countries around the globe are trying to develop a vaccine, and there is a fear that a country could hoard the vaccine or keep it to themselves. I mean, so you're saying that fear is real?
Yes. So vaccine nationalism is how I've been describing this, where one country seeks to preference their entire population over the vulnerable in the rest of the world. Now, at the end of the day, I think personally that is short-sighted, because if one country still has people with the virus, it affects all of us.
So if the goal of a vaccine is to stop the virus globally, what is the smartest way to distribute a hypothetical vaccine at some point?
The smartest way would be to ensure that the global allocation mechanism, which is being talked about and currently developed, will actually ensure that the vulnerable of the world get priority. We need a mechanism globally to decide, firstly, who those people are, and then secondly, to make sure that they are the first to receive this vaccine. There's still a way to go before we're in this position, but if we don't talk about this now, if we don't get it agreed now, I genuinely fear that we will see what happened in 2009, that the wealthy countries of the world will preference their entire populations before we actually provide vaccine to the truly vulnerable right around the world.
Remind us, 2009, what happened then?
2009, swine flu, as it was known. Basically, the big wealthy countries already had pre-pandemic contracts in place. And even though we had a global discussion about there being a proportion of vaccine provided to the rest of the world, even though in some cases people promised 10% of vaccine production, that wasn't delivered in all cases. So that meant that the wealthy were protected and people without those resources, without manufacturing onshore and the research, developed their own vaccines. They missed out.
The mantra these days is we're all in this together. Is there a way to actually get people to be embracing that idea in a very practical sense when it comes to a vaccine?
Well, of course, we can't make people. And I'm reminded of when my children were little and we all used to say to them, you know, play nice. And that's essentially what we're asking people to do here. We can't make people. We can't force them. But what I think we can do is be clear about what the globe's expectations are, that because we don't know who will succeed in the development of a vaccine, if we all agree that there obviously in any one country there is a need to meet domestic demand, particularly for the vulnerable, but if you're not looking out for everybody else, who's going to look out for you if you don't get there first?
Jane Halton is a commissioner in Australia's National COVID-19 Coordination Commission. She's also a former member of the WHO Executive Board. Thank you very much for being with us again, Jane Halton.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Another U.S. government inspector general is out of work. This time the axe fell on Steve Linnick, inspector general for the State Department. President Trump said Linnick had to go because he had lost confidence in him. But Linnick had been investigating Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. According to House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Elliot Engel, the inspector general was looking into possible misuse of government resources and into a fast-track multi-billion-dollar arms sale to Saudi Arabia. Nicholas Burns is a former U.S. ambassador to NATO and now teaches diplomacy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. We should also add Burns is an unpaid advisor to the Joe Biden campaign. Nick Burns, why does this firing matter?
It matters because the inspector generals who are in each government cabinet agency, they're the ones who hold government agencies accountable to the law, to the Congress, to make sure that there's waste or fraud or if someone has committed an illegal act, that's reported.
You were a career diplomat, Nick. What are you hearing about this latest news from your former colleagues still inside the Foreign Service at the State Department? How's it hitting morale?
Well, it's adding to the worsening of morale in the State Department because there's been an attempt by the Trump administration to cut the budget of state. State has been sidelined in many ways. The president has called the State Department the career people, the deep state. The president needs to explain to the Congress why Steve Linick was fired. It's just not good enough to say, I've lost confidence in him, not with an inspector general who has to be independent to do his or her job.
So folding this back into American relationships internationally, how does this kind of thing, accusations that your boss is abusing his power, how does that impact the practice of U.S. diplomacy?
Well, it has a major impact on whether or not foreign governments are going to see, in this case, the Secretary of State, someone who's in trouble politically or perhaps in trouble legally. It adds to the notion overseas that the Trump administration is fairly chaotic. And that the Trump administration is not focused as much as it should be on our alliances overseas, on some of the big pressing international issues that you and I have talked about on your program for many years, climate change, the Iran nuclear deal. In this case, the COVID-19 crisis, where the Trump administration really has been absent as a leader. And if Secretary Pompeo is seen to be someone who is now under investigation, it's going to add to the perception that the State Department and the Trump administration are not paying as much attention to the U.S.'s leadership roles as it should.
This is another inspector general that's taken a hit by the White House. I get questions from friends of mine overseas. How does Trump keep doing this and getting away with it? I suppose you get those questions too. How do you answer?
I do. I answer those questions by saying that the rule of law in the United States is at stake. President Trump, in many ways, has authoritarian tendencies. He doesn't seem to respect the rule of law. He's now fired four inspector generals, and these people should be fully protected from those kinds of actions by any American president. We have to be worried, and our best friends around the world are worried, that America's democracy is at stake and our leadership around the world is at stake if the president can act in this kind of way without any kind of consequences. So it's time for Republicans and Democrats in Congress to defend the rule of law, to defend the law that was created by Congress, to create the inspector generals and to put them into each of our cabinet agencies, because the American people should want our cabinet agencies to be transparent. And if there are transgressions of a law or of regulations, people need to be held to account.
Ambassador Nick Burns, professor of the practice of diplomacy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Nick, thanks as always.
Thank you, Marco.
Before the pandemic hit, Venice in Italy attracted some 30 million tourists a year. 30 million. Now they've vanished, along with the city's main source of revenue. Francesca Berardi reports on how residents there are coping.
Last Saturday morning, I boarded a small boat and traveled along the canals of Venice, a city built on more than 100 small islands connected by 400 bridges. The atmosphere was calm, even on the Grand Canal, where only a few months ago a cruise ship collided with a boat. The silence was broken only by the pilots of boats shouting to announce their arrival before turning into the narrowest canals. My destination was the historic Rialto Market, which is famous for fish, but has been at risk of closing for years. In pre-COVID times, there were more tourists taking pictures of fish than buying them. Now it's the other way around. The market is full of Venetians carrying shopping bags who can recognize which fish are local and which ones come from far away.
These here are St. Peter, tilapia fillets from the North Atlantic, Norwegian salmon, tuna from the Seychelles. Those prawns are Argentinian, mullets are French.
This is Luigi Di Vari, an artist, a former sea captain, and an expert on local marine life. Since the lockdown began more than 2 months ago, locals have spotted fish in the lagoon they never saw before. I asked him why this was.
Quando in un canale ci sono le barche che scorazzano, l'acqua è...
When boats are racing around the canal, the water is murky and people don't even look down at it. Now the water is clear, very calm, and people have started to notice that there's a jellyfish, a seahorse. But those were always there, you just couldn't see them.
For Venetians, the lockdown has been an opportunity to see not only life in the canals, but new perspectives across the city. The beauty and structure of this architectural miracle on water is now before everyone's eyes, as is the collective dilemma on one issue: the massive presence of tourists.
Fino a dicembre era il problema numero uno. Adesso è il problema numero uno perché manca.
Until December, tourism was the number one problem. Now it's the number one problem because it's missing. Before, people complained because tourists were there. Now they complain because they're gone.
But during the lockdown, residents were able to become tourists themselves, strolling through streets normally crammed with visitors and snapping selfies in front of the most iconic sites like Ponte di Rialto and Piazza San Marco. It was a reminder that Venice could be a very easy place to live. Maria Fiano is a co-founder of Ocho, an organization that advocates for housing rights in Venice.
Io ho sempre considerato questa città, che viene considerata all'interno del comune la città antica, come in realtà.
I've always considered this ancient city to be the city of the future. It's built at a human scale. Everything is reachable in a 10 or 15 minute walk. The city is designed for you to have encounters, chats, a sense of community.
I met Maria in a little square behind the market, between Venice's oldest church and one of the highest concentrations of bars, now closed. She was joined by her co-founder, Francesco Penzo. He says that the boom in online tourism platforms, such as Airbnb, has created a dire housing shortage for residents.
There is no housing for students, for professionals, for university professors who want to come here. When there are big cultural events like the Biennale, people who need a place can't find it.
Francesco says the outbreak of the pandemic seemed to create an opportunity to reflect on the future of the city, to imagine a city where residents and tourists could more easily coexist.
There was a moment of awareness in which we said, it's time to rethink. But I swear since last week when the lockdown ended, the only concern is to reopen everything, to bring back the tourists.
As Venice reopens, there is no plan to attract new residents or diversify the economy. The mayor and the people who vote for him just want mass tourism to come back. The Venetians are still suffering for the flooding that hit the city last November, the worst in 50 years. Those who are hoping for a change are pessimistic. Nino Zane feels mixed about all this. His family has been selling fresh fish at Rialto Market for generations. His main hope right now is to save his business, so he just wants things to return the way they were.
Si lavorava con i ristoranti, con altre robe. Era tanto più facile. Adesso è tutto.
Before the lockdown, I worked with restaurants and it was so much easier. Now everything is difficult, a constant worry. There are so many families who depend on this business.
For some Venetians, mass tourism seems like the only possible future. The pandemic had the surprising power to bring it to a halt, but most people feel, and some of them hope, that nothing will stop it once the global crisis has passed. For the moment, the best they can do is cope with an uncertain future and savor the sound of calm water. For The World, I'm Francesca Berardi.
The word moist. It's not a favorite for a lot of people, and yet chocolate cake, moist is a virtue. It's when moist is used in the midst of a pandemic that things get really tricky. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau recently tripped over the word when he was talking about the importance of wearing a mask to protect others.
Because it prevents you from breathing or speaking moistly on them. Oh, what a terrible image.
Hard to disagree, Mr. Prime Minister. A terrible image and a terrible word, especially as an adverb. Moist is actually regularly voted as one of the most hated words in the English language. Check out this video from Tech Insider.
Moist is part of a phenomenon known as word aversion. It refers to words with an inoffensive meaning, yet when you hear them, like crevice and phlegm, they have the unique power to disgust people.
Sometimes, though, it's good to have a word that really helps imagine the problem. For example, a principal in New Zealand wants kids there to be careful.
When you're feeling sick, you got to stay at home and stay out of my moist breath zone.
Yeah, moist breath zone. I get that. Principal Shirley Serban composed that 3-minute song as a health and safety message, encouraging kids to wash their hands and cough into their elbows. But the song also warns, if kids can smell the tuna bake their friends had for tea last night, you're too close. Tuna in the moist breath zone. Double ooh.
If I smell your breath, I will go sit on my own.
Great advice for all of us. You can watch the Moist Breath video on our Twitter feed. We're at The World. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston at WGBH. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you tomorrow.
Moist Breath Zone.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.